Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we mentioned earlier in the show, the race to develop a vaccine to protect against COVID-19 is moving at warp speed, hence the name, Operation Warp Speed. The drug company Pfizer announced last week that its vaccine was more than 90% effective in preventing COVID-19 symptoms. And just yesterday, Moderna announced similarly promising results from their ongoing study. Moderna's vaccine had an effectiveness rate close to 95%. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the U.S. government's top infectious disease expert, called these developments light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the pandemic. But just because there's a vaccine doesn't mean that people will take it when it becomes widely available. And there's sure to be a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccine's safety. Many Americans struggle with public health guidelines to wear a mask. Will a COVID-19 vaccine be an easier messaging battle? Laura Bogart holds a doctorate in behavioral psychology and is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. Her research focuses on medical mistrust, specifically in HIV prevention and treatment. Recently, she's been looking into mistrust of a COVID-19 vaccine and will be rolling out a new national survey on the topic in the next couple of weeks. Laura Bogart, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Brian.
I'd also like to welcome back Professor Chris Brook, a virologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He studies how viruses replicate and evolve at the Brook Lab. Chris, thank you for being with us as well.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And we still have, from our previous segment, Dr. Richard Novak, who's chief of infectious diseases at the University of Illinois Chicago and was a lead investigator of the clinical trials for the Moderna vaccine at UIC. Those were the phase 3 trials. And listeners, want to invite you into the conversation as well. If you have questions about the vaccine or maybe human behavior when it comes to taking the vaccine, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Novak, I'm sure a lot of people will be eager to take this vaccine as soon as it becomes available, but is there an ideal number of Americans you'd like to see take the vaccine in order for it to be most effective at ending this pandemic? Is there a percentage target that we're aiming for?
Well, an ideal world, everybody would take it, but obviously that's not going to happen. But first, of course, we'd have to have supply. But you've probably heard of the term herd immunity. And the goal for herd immunity is to get about 70% of the population immunized. And with that, we'd see the pandemic fade away. So that would be the ultimate goal. And that's a pretty heavy lift.
And herd immunity, I think maybe has gotten a bit of a bad rap from some of the misinformation or bad ideas that have been put out there about it. But you're talking about herd immunity achieved not just by mass infection, but by immunization as well as whatever percentage of people have been infected and might have developed their own immunity. Yeah.
Herd immunity is a term that we've often referred to in the setting of vaccination. It's not solely related to the spread of natural disease. So you can achieve herd immunity by immunizing people. And that would definitely be the goal of our vaccine effort.
Professor Brook, I wonder as a virologist if you have a perspective on that question about, you know, mass vaccination and the level you would need to achieve immunity.
Sure. So I think that the rate of vaccination that you need to reach that sort of herd immunity threshold that Dr. Novak was talking about is to an extent dependent upon the efficacy of the vaccine. So with a lower efficacy vaccine, you need a higher percentage of people to be vaccinated. With a higher efficacy vaccine, you don't need quite as high percentage of uptake. And so I think the preliminary results from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines showing that both of these are highly, highly effective or very promising from the standpoint of, you know, what sort of vaccination uptake we would really need to achieve to stamp this thing out.
And Dr. Bogart, can you talk then about an obstacle to vaccine distribution being lack of trust or medical misinformation about the vaccine? How concerned are you about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Mistrust can be an obstacle. I mean, we've already been seeing national surveys and recent surveys showing there are high levels of mistrust around a vaccine and also around the government response to COVID-19 in general. So, for example, people are saying the government's withholding a cure, hiding information. They're also saying things like pharmaceutical companies encourage the spread of COVID-19 to make money. And these aren't just small percentages of people in surveys. This is a large percentage of people in national surveys.
Professor Brooke, I wonder, this vaccine was created in 11 months, and we've been hearing, you know, in the past, vaccines have taken years, in some cases decades earlier on. Yesterday, the head of the National Institutes of Health was on the PBS NewsHour and insisted no corners were cut. I wonder, what is your perspective on the speed at which this vaccine was developed?
Well, it's certainly unprecedented, but then this is, an unprecedented challenge, at least over the last 100 years. And so the rapid development of this vaccine or this collection of vaccine candidates has been supported in a way that vaccine research usually is not. And it's also important to point out that in reality, these vaccines weren't started from scratch, you know, back at the beginning of the pandemic. They're building on research that had been carried out on vaccine technologies and development of just general coronavirus vaccines going back years.
I want to go now to the phones. Listeners, you're welcome to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to go to line one. Chuck is calling on the road. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hi. Yes, my question is, of the 5 to 10% of the people in the test programs that are ruled as ineffective, what's the criteria for making them ineffective? Do they develop a mild case of the coronavirus? Do they develop full-blown coronavirus, or do they die?
Okay, thank you for that question, Chuck. It was a little hard to hear. Dr. Novak, I wonder if you can talk about that, the 5.5% of the people who were, you know, for whom this vaccine was not effective.
Well, so actually they have very good data on that. And there were 11 serious cases of coronavirus in the study population. And all 11 of those occurred in the placebo arm. In other words, the vaccine was able to keep people from getting serious coronavirus disease. So the people who did get infection had mild cases. And that was one of the endpoints of the vaccine trial, to see if it would make the disease milder in those people who got it. It appears that that was the case.
You know, I wonder if you can talk a little bit more. We've had a lot of questions about the speed, and I mentioned that earlier, Dr. Novak. You know, do you worry that people might be skeptical about the safety of the vaccine because of how quickly this process has gone this year? And what can you say to reassure them?
Well, yes, of course, I do worry, because the vaccine is only good if people take the vaccine. And so we have to convince people that it is safe. And I think 95% efficacy does go a long way in convincing people that it's an effective vaccine. I think we're still collecting safety data. As I mentioned earlier, the safety profile of the vaccine actually looks quite good. But there's a tremendous amount of skepticism in society at large, particularly in racial and ethnic minorities who have been in the past have been abused in clinical trials historically, and even though that's not been the case in the last 50 years, it's still in memory, and it comes up often in discussions about vaccine trials and also in vaccine distribution. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation about vaccines in general, and it's easy to go online and find a wealth of information that's misleading about vaccines. And so the onus is on us to convince people that this is a safe vaccine. As Chris pointed out, these vaccines were not developed from scratch. They were, even though it seems like it happened very quickly, it was built on many years of development of these vaccine designs, the vaccine platforms in which the product was administered. And we also had a number of years of research just on the antigen that was used in this vaccine, because we had prior coronavirus outbreaks worldwide, the SARS virus and the MERS virus, which use a similar protein to get inside cells. And so there was a lot of research done on that protein before we had the actual sequence of SARS-CoV-2.
Professor Bogart, I wonder, your work has focused on on HIV and also skepticism of the medical establishment. We heard Dr. Novak there talking about certain communities which have been abused by the medical establishment over time. Do we have a sense of what communities might be more reluctant to take the vaccine or trust the science this time around?
Yes, we do. Several national surveys have suggested Black Americans may be less likely to take the vaccine. So, for example, there was a recent survey in August and September finding that half of Black Americans versus 65% of whites would definitely or probably get the vaccine. And I've done my own research among Black Americans in LA living with HIV, and finding that 60% said the government can't be trusted to tell the truth about COVID-19. Half said they're worried a vaccine might be harmful and that they wouldn't want to take a vaccine. And people who had higher mistrust in the government response to COVID-19 and more beliefs and mistrust-related beliefs, such as conspiracy beliefs about COVID-19, were also less likely to want to take the vaccine. And obviously, this is understandable. I mean, Black Americans have a long history of experiencing systemic racism in society as a whole, as well as in healthcare and unethical medical experimentation in the past. And so it makes sense Black Americans might mistrust a new medical technology such as a vaccine, given that these unethical medical experimentations and other injustices. And so people might be concerned that this is just another example of medical experimentation and treating a community like guinea pigs. And that's some sentiment that we have heard in communities throughout this pandemic.
What about language barriers? Will non-English speakers, do we have a sense if they'll have more trouble accessing information around the vaccine? We've certainly heard that through just information about masking and treatment of COVID-19. Are they more prone to medical misinformation?
Yes, we've also heard that there have been language barriers, such as information not being available right away in Spanish and people not being able to get the information they need, so trying to rely on other people in their communities, and that might just propagate misinformation. So it's really important at all stages of this pandemic, including rolling out a vaccine, that we have language not be a barrier, that we make materials available in all languages.
Okay, I want to go back to the phones now at 800-222-9455. Carol, you are on the line from Harvard on line two. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Thank you. I wondered if people do not return for their second vaccine, could the virus mutate and become resistant, like happens with antibiotics?
Okay, good question, Carol. Thank you. Dr. Novak, do you want to weigh in on that one?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. It was, if somebody misses, if they skip out on their second vaccine, could this lead to the virus mutating the way, you know, we've heard a lot with, certainly with antibiotics, over-prescribing there, that leads to mutations. If somebody misses their second dose of the virus, could that be problematic, I guess, for a population level?
Well, it's an interesting question, although, you know, vaccines work differently than antibiotics, and that they're really promoting an immune response, and so what might happen if you miss your second dose is you won't get as high as durable an immune response, so it won't last as long as if you got both doses, and so your immunity would wane over time, and you might become again susceptible to the virus. Do viruses respond to the immune response by mutating? They do. I don't know how much that's going to be a factor with coronaviruses. It's certainly an issue with HIV, for example, but it's an interesting theoretical question, but I have a feeling that it's probably not an important clinical question. In other words, it probably doesn't happen very much.
Okay. And I also want to go back to the phones. Susan is on from Springfield, line one. Thank you for calling in, Susan. What's your question?
Thank you. My question is, have the trials included people 65 and over And then my second question is, what is the confidence that these speakers have that either one of these vaccines will be safe for those over 65?
Okay, thank you for that question. I guess, Dr. Novak, I'll go back to you since I know your time with us is limited and you obviously were one of the lead researchers on this trial. What can you say about the over 65 population in just about a minute and a half before we need to take a break?
Yeah, well, we actually did include a lot of people over the age of 65. It was one of the target populations because people over the age of 65 tend to do worse with the coronavirus infections. They have a higher hospitalization and death rates. So they were included, I think about over 40% of the study population was over the age of 65 or had what we call comorbidities, other underlying chronic illnesses. And they actually did very well in response to the vaccine. They did as well as everybody else.
Okay. And so, I mean, you have a sense of the safety for that age group as well?
Similarly, the vaccine didn't have any particular safety issues thus far in the older population. So that we have every reason to believe that the vaccine will be safe and we know it's effective.
Okay.
Our population as well.
Okay. Well, we're gonna continue this conversation. We still have some callers waiting. We have more questions we didn't get to. Dr. Novak, I know you need to leave us. You have a class coming up. So I want to thank Dr. Richard Novak, Chief of Infectious Disease at the University of Illinois Chicago and a lead investigator on the Moderna clinical trials, phase 3 trials for their vaccine at UIC. Dr. Novak, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to continue with Professor Chris Brook from the University of Illinois, a virologist there, and Professor Laura Bogart, who's a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and teaches at the Pardee RAND Graduate School. We're going to continue taking your questions at 800-222-9455, particularly on the behavioral aspects of the vaccine and, getting people to actually take it once it becomes sufficiently available. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the big vaccine news in the last 2 weeks. So far, two of the major efforts to develop a vaccine against COVID-19 have come out with early preliminary results. We should emphasize these have not been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals yet, but so far the Pfizer effort reported a 90% effectiveness in preventing symptoms of or severe COVID-19, and Moderna's vaccine reported close to 95% effectiveness rate. We are taking your questions and we are talking about this, particularly the behavioral aspects of it, with Laura Bogart, who is a PhD senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, as well as Chris Brook, who's a professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And we did have a call who didn't want to go on air, didn't want to hang on the line, but Chris, I wonder if you can answer this. Mike in Champaign was wondering if this is the first RNA vaccine that will be used in the general population. Can you talk about that and how this might differ from some other vaccines in the past?
For sure. Yeah, so that's correct. This is going to be the first widely used RNA-based vaccine in humans. This is a relatively new vaccine technology that has certainly been tested in some trials previously against other viruses. But this is really kind of a new technology.
And can I try out? So this is, those of us who haven't had biology since high school, my understanding is, many old vaccines, you would take some actual virus, maybe inactivated somehow, and inject it into the person and get them to sort of produce an immune response. Whereas my understanding here, you have the RNA is basically a blueprint for the little spikes, right? You picture the ball of COVID. We've all seen the picture a million times with those little spikes. And this RNA tells the body to make more of the spikes, which produces an immune response, so that when the actual coronavirus comes in, the body sees the spikes on that and already knows how to respond to it? Is that like a fair, poor layperson's summary of what this is doing?
That's a great description. So absolutely, you should think of this RNA vaccine is basically, this RNA is basically a set of instructions that when it gets into your cells, it tells them how to make this viral protein so that your immune system can see it and develop a response against it. And one of the reasons why, I mean, these RNA vaccines are very exciting because the old fashioned vaccines, you had to be able to isolate the virus and grow it up and make lots of virus particles that you could then inactivate and inject into people. That's still how some vaccines like the flu vaccine are made. But because this is just a set of molecular instructions, we didn't need to grow the virus or anything in order to start work on the vaccine. So as soon as someone had sequenced the genome of this virus, they could take the sequence for the spike, plop it into the pre-existing RNA vaccine platform, and start the experiments. So it really helped accelerate the response.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have those vaccines in mind as they're pondering this one, because we got a text from Tana in rural Menard County who asked in part, do any of the vaccines being developed have live virus in them? And we also got a question texted to us from John in Rockford, who said, I'm old enough to remember to have taken part in the mass immunization campaign that vaccinated hundreds of thousands of school children like me with the Salk vaccine against polio in 1955. Are the organizers of the COVID-19 immunization campaign reviewing that bit of history? As I have come to know since then, one batch of the Salk vaccine caused 40,000 cases of polio, killing 10. Even though that vaccine has been extensively tested before it was approved for use. And then he goes on to talk about the warp speed process and the development and whether there may have been some corner cutting with that. And I think he's referring to it's known as the Cutter incident, which is the name of the lab that kind of botched its manufacture of this vaccine. Laura Bogart, I wonder if you can talk to that. As sort of, I've seen that referred to as kind of one of the seed events for the growing distrust of vaccines that still persists today.
Yes, that is very important to take into account. And, related to what the listener said, there's already been media reports and also lots of anecdotal evidence of people saying they think the vaccine timeline has been sped up for political reasons, fears that the vaccine may not be going through proper channels to be safe. So this is definitely something we need to be concerned about and think about and address head on directly and talk about it openly.
Well, I think we might have a caller on the line with a question along those lines. Lindsay is on the line from Springfield. Lindsay, are you there? And what is your question? Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm right here. Yeah,
thanks.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
You know, we've had the outbreak in 67, 68, and 76, and those vaccines were done way earlier than 4 years. To me, it seems like saying it takes 4 years for these vaccines spreads fear. So why do you always say it takes 4 years to develop
I think we lost the connection, but we got the gist of the question there. Thanks for calling in, Lindsay. Professor Brooke, Chris Brooke, do you want to take that? I mean, about the timeline for the vaccines?
Sure, that's a great question. So I think the distinction to keep in mind is that those pandemics that the caller mentioned were influenza virus pandemics. And in those instances, we already had an influenza vaccine that was being widely used, and we still do. And it just required a fairly minimal modification of what we were already using, basically the same modification that we do every single year. So we were able to kind of use the pre-existing vaccine in those cases. The 4 years of these sightings kind of like the world record for development of a new vaccine where there hadn't been one previously. And that was for, I believe, the mumps virus. I think this is, again, a situation where we don't have any pre-existing coronavirus vaccines that are used in people. And so we are really starting from further back than was the case in those influenza pandemics. But it's important to point out these distinctions because I can understand how people would get confused about that.
Yeah, sure. And Laura Bogart, I wonder if you have a thought on that. How do you tell people a vaccine produced in 8 to 10 months is safe when in the past it's taken a lot longer for these vaccines?
Yes, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. One thing to think about is that the reasons for mistrust may differ by community. So we can't have a one-size-fits-all approach. So some people might be concerned about the length of time it took to develop the vaccine. Other people may simply just not trust at all new technologies or new vaccines. Other people might have safety concerns, effectiveness concerns. So what we need to do is take time to get to know people's concerns and questions and reasons for mistrust. And also, what sources of information do they trust so that we can convey the information, for example, that Chris just conveyed very eloquently, and talk to people and provide this accurate information and find out who do they listen to in their communities to provide this information. So in other words, I'm thinking like any new product, we need to do marketing research first, understand by community why people don't trust the vaccine, who they trust, and then what kinds of beliefs do we need to address?
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with Laura Bogart, who's a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and a faculty member on the Pardee RAND Graduate School. And we're also speaking with Chris Brook, who's a virologist and professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're taking your questions and the remaining time we have left this hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, talking about the vaccine news in the past week or so about the surprisingly, I think it's fair to say, surprisingly effective preliminary results for the Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines. Professor Bogart, you were just mentioning there about surveying people. And so you're actually putting together a survey. Can you talk about the process there and what else you hope to learn from people besides what might be motivating their fears of a vaccine?
Yes, thank you. So along with other colleagues at RAND, I'm about to launch a national survey probably by the end of this week. And we're going to focus on Black Americans, given the high levels of mistrust that I spoke about before, and ask about vaccine hesitancy, reluctance to take a vaccine, but also different reasons for mistrust around COVID-19 and around a vaccine. And so we'll do this survey nationally with around 200 people. But then we're going to pick out the people in the survey who had the highest levels of mistrust and actually do in-depth interviews with them and talk to them and say, no, what? Why do you have mistrust? What are the reasons? What are the kinds of things that you might do to address this mistrust? What would make you feel better about the vaccine? And then as another component of the project, we actually convened a national community advisory board of community stakeholders in Black communities. And what we'll do is meet with them monthly for about 8 months and talk about what kinds of information do we need to use for marketing purposes of the vaccine? What do we need to tell communities? What kinds of messaging? And also, what kinds of places should people access the vaccine? What are the trusted sources of information and trusted providers of healthcare and other services in their communities?
Professor Chris Brook, I want to ask you, this vaccine was 90% effective for the Pfizer, 94.5% for the Moderna results that just came out yesterday. That seems much more effective than the flu shot we've heard about. Can you talk about the varying effective rates of various vaccines that people might be familiar with and how this one would compare to other vaccines that people have taken?
Sure. So you're right. So the standard seasonal flu vaccine that we get every year, its efficacy ranges from 30% to 60% roughly. And that's because it changes because it's actually a vaccine against four different viruses, and those viruses are changing every year and the vaccine's changing every year. So it varies. I was very pleasantly surprised to see those numbers for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Those are really, really, really good efficacy numbers for a vaccine, putting it really at the upper end of what's possible. No vaccine is 100% effective. I think that's why everyone is so pleased about this, is because it's really best case scenario for how these vaccines are performing, at least on the efficacy side.
And in just the few minutes we have remaining, I want to take one more text from a listener. This is Justin in Rockford, who texted in to say, I realize many people will not want to get the vaccine, but since the vaccine is not perfect, should we have proof of vaccination that we would be required to carry into large gatherings where if someone were unvaccinated, they wouldn't risk anyone else's safety? Laura Bogart, I wonder if you want to take that. I mean, we've already seen with mask wearing has become very politicized in a lot of ways in this country. Do you see a sort of role for some sort of government rule in terms of vaccination or some sort of gatekeeping function for mass events? Or what are your thoughts on that?
A great question. I mean, as you said, everything's been politicized around COVID-19, and there's already media reports of people feeling like the vaccine is politicized as well. So I think a larger government role in basically ordering people to do things may not work as well as what I was talking about with each community deciding what's right for them in terms of the vaccine, in terms of where to access the vaccine and what kinds of messaging is appropriate. So as we know from psychology, telling people to do things directly doesn't always work. We need to work with them and figure out, for example, their reasons for mistrust, their reasons for not wanting to take the vaccine, and work with that reason to try to convince people that this is the best course of action for them.
Okay. And I think we're going to leave. You'll go ahead. If you have any final
thoughts. I did want to say there is, you know, the government in these national surveys, we found that the government, especially the federal government, has not been trusted around the COVID-19 vaccine response. But the other thing that surveys have shown is that doctors and other healthcare providers are trusted sources of information around COVID-19 and the vaccine. So this suggests there'll be more success if healthcare providers educate people around the vaccine rather than elected officials.
So getting sort of closer to the ground, your local contacts are going to have a better shot than the president on the evening news convincing people that this is the right thing to do. All right. We are going to leave the conversation there. I want to thank Laura Bogart, who is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, and Chris Brook, who's an assistant professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology and a virologist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge with us in this important conversation today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, I did mention at the top of the show that we would be bringing you a conversation with Justin Johnson. He is the 2021 State Board of Education Teacher of the Year for Illinois. We did bump that because we had so many questions about the virus. We will be bringing you that conversation later this week. And that is all the time we have for today, though. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can get a podcast of our show on our website at 21stshow.org, where you can also find all the ways to reach us, voicemail, email. We do want to hear what you thought about our show today. I'm Brian Mackey, and we will be back with another show tomorrow.